Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois. I'm back with another episode, and we have with us Jim Cassidy, who's the pastor of South Austin OPC in Austin, Texas. Welcome back, Jim. It's good to have you again.
Great to be here as always, Camden. Thanks.
Yeah, we really appreciate you taking the time and joining us for another excellent conversation. Today we're really excited. I'm very excited to speak with our guest, Gerald Hestand, who is the co-author of a wonderful new book titled The Pastor Theologian, Resurrecting an Ancient Vision. Gerald is a senior associate pastor of Calvary Memorial Church in Oak Park, Illinois, as well as the executive director and one of the co-founders of the Center for Pastor Theologians. Welcome to the program, Gerald. It's great to speak with you.
Yeah, it's great to be with you guys.
Well, today we're going to be speaking about this new book and the very important subject of the pastor theologian. It has a rich history in the Christian tradition, but also it has disappeared in certainly some and many quarters. And there's certainly an awful lot of misunderstanding as to what a pastor theologian is or how they ought to function. And we're going to get into all of this as we look at this new book, which is published by Zondervan. But before we open the pages of this wonderful title, I needed to mention a few things. First, that Christ the Center is listener-supported. We do rely on the generous support of all of our listeners to help us produce and distribute all of our programs and distribute them around the world. We're very excited to record all of our conversations. It's a tremendous blessing to us, but we're very thankful that we can share in that blessing by recording them, producing them, and putting the recordings online so that people in all sorts of different countries and all sorts of different ecclesial contexts can actually listen. Visit us online today at reformedforum.org/donate to pledge your support. And while you're on the website, we also encourage you to visit our conference page, reformedforum.org/conference. There you'll find information about our upcoming theology conference, October 16th through 18th, held here in Grays Lake, Illinois. We're welcoming Richard Gaffin and Lane Tipton as plenary speakers to speak about the Spirit and the church. So we're looking at the cross-section and connection between pneumatology and ecclesiology. So it's a wonderful topic to plumb the depths, and we are looking forward to all of you joining us and participating. The space is limited so that we can encourage actual legitimate interaction and conversation among all of the speakers, the Reform Forum regulars and contributors, and all the people in attendance. So register now. We have an early bird rate in effect, and you can reserve your spot at reformedforum.org/conference. While we're mentioning conferences, even in the Chicagoland area, we also have an excellent conference. This is the first time I mentioned it on the air, but the Center for Pastor Theologians is hosting a conference on the Pastor Theologian, Identities and Possibilities, November 2nd through 4th. Gerald, would you tell us more about this conference and who's going to be speaking?
Yeah, I'd love to. This is the first annual conference of the Center for Pastor Theologians, and we're excited with this inaugural conference to really explore just what is the identity of the pastor theologian, what are the possibilities for pastor theologians in today's ministry context. And we have Peter Lighthart is going to be joining us, and James K.A. Smith will be joining us as well,
yeah.
Dr. Kevin Van Hooser. And then my co-author of the book that we'll be discussing today is Dr. Todd Wilson. He's the senior pastor of the church where I serve. And so he and I will also be giving plenary addresses. But then we have a fair number of breakout sessions that are going to be led by a number of pastors from the center. Mm-hmm. And Phil Reichen will be joining us for some time, David Dockery, and others. And so we're super excited to gather all these folks together. It's an eclectic group. We have a representation kind of across broad streams. It's Reformed leaning.
Yeah,
but it's not a strictly Reformed conference, and we're hoping to gather quite a few students and academics who are interested in the pastor theologian possibilities, pastors, of course, and even lay leaders that would be curious about how this might be worked out in their church with their pastors. So we're really excited about it. Look forward to gathering a group together.
Yeah, we're excited about it too. And I know that many of the people that have been involved in either attending or participating in some of the center's activities include Jason Hood, as well as Owen,
yep,
Strand and Chris Castaldo. We have interviewed all of these men in the past on Christ the Center. So there's a lot of horsepower at the center. Could you tell us just a bit about how the center came about and what some of your annual activities are, even beyond the theology conference?
Yeah, the center started back in 2006, and I had been looking for a, well, I'll maybe even start further back. I did my master's degree at TED in Deerfield and was studying at that time with Doug Sweeney. And I distinctly remember I had been in pastoral ministry. I was taking some time off of pastoral ministry and was doing this MA. And I was taking Dr. Sweeney's Jonathan Edwards class. And Doug is one of the resident Edwards experts up there. And he noted that in Edwards' day, the main theologians of Congregational New England were the pastors, and the pastors provided the far and away the bulk of the theological leadership to the Christian community. And it struck me that we live in a day where it's largely the reverse, and I think this can be more acute in certain sectors, but certainly in my sector of Christendom here in North America, it definitely is the reverse, where the theologians are in the academy and the pastors are in much more of a passive posture in relation to the academy theologically. And it seemed to me that was running in the wrong direction. And so I began to think about what it would look like to try to, not in a kind of a naive utopian way, try to get back to 16th century New England, which, you know, we live in a different world now, but how might we go back to reclaiming the pastorate as a principle of vocation for, as it were, professional theologians. And that led me to connect with some others. Todd Wilson was the principal catalyst and partner in that. And so he and I began to brainstorm the idea for Center. And in the early years, all we really did was try to just find other people that we knew who were interested in combining theological scholarship and pastoral ministry. And by theological scholarship, I would say pastors that wanted to continue producing theological scholarship. So not just theologically informed pastors, but pastors that wanted to actually produce theological scholarship. And so we found a group of pastors and began to create what we call pastor theologian fellowships. And so we have three of them now. Each pastor theologian fellowship has about 18 pastors in it. Each fellowship meets once a year here in Chicago area, and it really is largely a networking and kind of a blow wind in the sails sort of gathering. We've brought in Kevin Van Hooser, Jamie Smith, Peter Lightheart, which is how we got connected with these guys. Doug Sweeney's been around, and others, to talk to us about various topics. And so we explore topics and present papers. But the three fellowships that meet have been kind of the core. Out of that has developed a print journal, our Bulletin of Ecclesial Theology, that now is the distillation of the papers that are presented at our fellowship symposium. We have received some grant funding to create a couple of funded fellowships for some book projects on faith science from the John Templeton Foundation. And then the conference is our next kind of big programming move that we've done this year. So we're excited about some of the reach that now we're starting to be able to move into some new territories.
Yeah, it's very exciting. I'm delighted to hear about it and hopefully can participate in some capacity, but it's very exciting to hear that there are other people out there that are very concerned with the kinds of things that we're concerned with here at Reform Forum, and so to have some cross-pollinization and to speak with one another about theological scholarship in the context of the church and for the church is what really being an ecclesial theologian is all about. And that's really the center here of the book, The Pastor Theologian. But you've alluded to some issues that are out there and certain conceptions that we're all striving against in the church today. Your first chapter in the book is titled Pastor or Theologian? A Division of Labor a crisis of identity. And I was speaking with a friend, and he might have gotten this joke from you, actually, but you know, when you have an academic theologian or a professor out there who serves in their local church, they're lauded and praised. But when you have a pastor of a local church who engages in some, you know, activities in the academy or maybe writes a theological article for a journal, sometimes they're decried as, you know, trying to do more than they ought to do, or being divided and not committed to the ministry of the church.
Right.
What kind of crisis of identity are many pastors and scholars faced with today?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things, and we go into them a little bit in the book, but I think there's a lot of things that have resulted in modernity that have come about through modernity that have resulted in a strong bifurcation between the pastor and the theologian. So again, to kind of hark back to in our North American context, that if someone were to say so-and-so was a theologian in the 16th century, that would almost naturally be understood to mean that the person was a clergy of some sort, a pastor in a church. Whereas now the moniker theologian almost by definition moves one into an academic context, and you have to put the descriptor pastor theologian in front of it to designate it. So the default theologian is now the academic, not the pastor. And I think that has resulted in two things. I think it's resulted in academic theology. Now that our theologians principally, and again, this is not universal, but principally reside or understood to reside in the academy, that theology itself is now by default academic theology. So even when we're talking about the work of the center or the book, we're often I'm often spoken of as a pastor who does academic theology, and that's not what I do. And,
right.
And maybe we'll talk a bit about that. But theology is just synonymous with the academy now.
Right.
And I think what's happened is theology has become ecclesially weak or anemic. It lacks an ecclesial center and distinctiveness sometimes. Again, not all. I don't want to be universal here, but I think generally speaking, this is true. And then on the flip side, I think as pastors have broadly less and less conceived of their role as a theologian, the churches have become theologically anemic. And so I think some sectors have fared better than other sectors of Christendom in that. But I don't think pastors generally in many denominational contexts or traditions think of themselves or even have the possibility of thinking of themselves as theologians, that the road is forked pretty stiffly, I think, or severely.
You had mentioned about modernity and how there are some characteristics to modernity which have perhaps led to the bifurcation of the pastor and the theologian. Was there a time before modernity when and where and how you might point to give us perhaps a better model other than what has been given to us today in and by modernity?
Yeah, that's a great question. And in the first two chapters of the book, we kind of make an initial scratch at this. I think there's a lot of work that could be done here. But we look at there's a number of collections of works, Meunier's Patrologia Cursus Completus, which has both the Latin and Greek fathers and doctors of the church. I mean, basically what this collection of works was attempting to do was to gather together all of the extant works from the apostolic fathers up until into the 15th century. And there's another collection of texts that does something similar, the Alexander Street Press's a collection of texts from the Reformation and then the Catholic Counter-Reformation. So collectively, there's about 500 different authors represented in these texts, spanning from the Apostolic Fathers through up until about the early 1700s.
Mm.
And one of the things that we did is we just looked at and did biographical searches on the authors in these volumes just to see where vocationally did they reside. And I don't think we came up with anything that is new or revisionist or novel, but I do think what what those volumes show is what historically we know to be true, is that there was a day when pastoral ministry, work in the church proper, was a predominant vocation of theologians. I think you see this particularly clearly in a post-Constantinian world when Christianity becomes more settled in, and there's more space vocationally, particularly for bishops, to engage in theological work. And as the church could gather resources around cathedral churches in the Middle Ages, the Reformation, interestingly, in the Protestant side, saw a return of theologians back into the churches. And I don't know all the reasons for that. I think probably some of it was theologians who were teaching in Catholic universities obviously had to vacate those posts. And I think the church was still considered a very viable option for theologians. And so, you know, you can point to a who's who's list of the most influential theologians in the church. And you get, you know, from Irenaeus to Athanasius to Clement, all the way through up into, you know, Augustine, all the way up through into the Reformation era. And you're going to find that not all of them, but significant majority of them, or a significant portion of them, were clergy in some fashion. And then in the North America, and what I think happens is that as you get into modernity, you have kind of the intellectual culture wars that are going on between much of just kind of the secularism that's emerging in Europe. And that, I think, affects the universities in a way that then has a negative impact on how theology is viewed generally. And then the place of a theologian just in society, whether a pastor theologian or an academic theologian, I think theologians took a hit during that time. The same narrative, I think, for different reasons, runs through in the North American context. I think the Second Great Awakening, the Revolution, have some things to play in there as well. But we go into some of this in the book. But the long answer to your short question is yes. I think there was a time in the history of the church where there was not such a strict bifurcation. And it's really only, I think, been in the last couple hundred years of the history of the church that we've seen such a strong bifurcation of the pastor and the theologian.
And that coincides with, perhaps even is caused by, that's a question for historians more closely, but by the rise of the university, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, the universities are emerging in the 12th century, 13th, 14th century. But what's interesting is that, and this was one thing that was a little surprising to be looking at the collections we looked at. The rise of the university did shift theologians into, like, out of the pastorate, out of the monasteries, because that was another place that theologians were residing, into the universities. But it was not a universal sort of just complete
exodus or
migration. It was not. It really maintained a fairly reputable or equitable division of labor up until you get into, I think, the Enlightenment. That's where it seems, as the university secularized, that's where things seem to really create the shift.
Yeah, and you do cite several important history volumes. I'm looking at my shelf right now. One of them is George Marsden's The Soul of the American University. But there are a lot of good volumes out there that can describe the changes that have happened in different contexts, not just in North America. But it's important to recognize, as the universities rise and secularize, that has an effect on the on theologians in the church.
It does. That's right. That's right.
Now, it's very interesting if you look at the American context, I think, especially when we consider the way in which before specialization, it'd be a really interesting question to ask how specialization has an impact upon this entire question, because before the rise of the seminary here in America, pastors were generally trained on an apprentice model, where they would go and they would train under a pastor, and they would learn from that pastor how to be a theologian and how to be a pastor. They would learn everything from their practical theology to their systematic theology, the Greek and their Hebrew, etc. The seminary comes along and brings about, by necessity, really, you know, specialization, and which gives the seminary a sense of necessity and an academic twist to it that ends up, I think, perhaps accenting the bifurcation between the pastor and the theologian. But that's kind of my preface to and my lead up to a practical question I have. And the question I think that comes to my mind, and perhaps to the minds of our listeners, is when they begin to hear the language of a pastor theologian, there are many within even our own circles here within a confessional reform setting that may begin to grow a little bit nervous, thinking, okay, so what does that look like in terms of ministry? Does that look like a congregation of people who are not visited because the pastor's too busy reading and writing? Does it look like a pastor who gets up there and gives systematic theology lectures rather than a sermon that directs the Word of God to the conscience and to the hearts and the minds of God's people? Now, obviously, I'm not on board of that type of bifurcation, but some are worried and they are concerned about how that looks on the ground. Would you be able to give us some of your thoughts about what the pastor theologian doesn't look like, as well as what he does look like here now in a postmodern context?
The concerns that you raised there, I think, are exactly right. And I think, I mean, to be fair, they're legitimate at points.
Mm-hmm.
I think in some ways, not in every way, but I think in some ways, some of the Second Great Awakening is a response to the frustration of what was perceived, whether rightly or wrongly, and probably a little bit of both, was perceived as kind of a dead orthodoxy and learning that, you know, didn't touch people in real places in their lives. So I do think there's a danger there, and I think those of us that have an interest and an enthusiasm for the pastor theologian need to recognize that that is a ditch that there's a potential for us to fall into. But certainly, the vision that I have, and I think that we all would share for the pastor theologian, is not one that disconnects from the congregation or disconnects from relationships, but that rather the congregation and relationships and shepherding and a genuine heartfelt affection of love for God and neighbor and for the mission of Christ needs to be the driving impulse that organizes all of our theological labor. So theological labor needs to be in service of Christ and mission and people and love, not the other way around. And I just think it's possible to get those reversed. I certainly think that that is a possibility. It's a danger we need to be aware of, but it's not inherently the case that that is going to happen or that it must happen. And there's dangers on the other side too. And so congregants, I think, are right to ask those questions and to raise those concerns. And I think we just have to take that seriously and then demonstrate through our ministry that those fears need not be realized in our particular context.
Gerald, one of the really excellent chapters, though the entire book is excellent, but one thing I think that I really contemplated quite some time, and I'd love to hear you interact with this more, but in chapter 6, you introduce a pastor-theologian taxonomy. Now, many people have an idea of what a pastor-theologian is, but even within that category, we can think of different roles or different types. And it's helpful to lay this taxonomy out, but you label three different types of pastor theologians. All of them are not opposed to, but they're distinguished from the academic theologian. So I want to say that from the outset. But could you describe for us the three types of pastor theologians here, and just in broad strokes, explain how they differ from one another?
Yeah, this is like probably our one proprietary insight of the book that really the book anchors around and hinges around. The pastor theologian, the identity of the pastor theologian is it's a subjective term now. So an academic theologian is an objective term. An academic theologian is someone that whose vocation is the academy and they produce works of theological scholarship. But the term pastor theologian has become a subjective term that I think for most people means something like a really smart pastor or a pastor who takes theology seriously, or a pastor who has a lot of theology books in his study, this sort of thing. I think it's not real clear what a pastor theologian is. So we worked to try to think through what are some of the ways that the pastor theologian is conceived of today, and what might be a new way not to replace those previous conceptions, but to supplement those conceptions. So we think of the pastor theologian as a local theologian. This would be one way to think of the pastor theologian. And the pastor theologian as local theologian is the pastor who has a very self-conscious understanding of their import in bringing theological leadership to their local congregation. And so they view the kind of the sheep of their fold as the, not necessarily the limits, but certainly the focus of their theological scholarship and leadership. And so the pastor theologian is local theologian. I would say that this is probably this is the default understanding of the pastor theologian. This is the pastor who takes theology seriously, thinks theologically in their preaching, thinks theologically through their leadership. Theology is not a side element, but is something that is very integrated into the whole of their ministry. So the pastor theologian is local theologian for the local congregation. The other identity of the pastor theologian that I think is out there is the pastor theologian as popular theologian. And here, this is the pastor theologian who is working to produce theological work. So they're actually writing some things and probably have a publishing ministry of some sort. Maybe it's a really popular blog. Often it's books. But the primary audience of their work is other congregants. So it's a popularizing, and I don't mean that in any kind of diminutive way, but it's a popularizing of Christology or atonement theory in ways that academics talk about it in their intramural conversations that are important, but it needs to be brought to bear in the life of real people in the pews. And so the popular theologians, pastor theologians, popular theologian is someone that is able to translate and broker, as it were, between the academic community and the congregant. So that's another, I think, super important role of the pastor theologian. I think there's quite a few pastors that serve that function.
Now, that's really the model that David Wells describes often, the broker model. But I think just for the listeners to put some names or connect people in our context, folks like an R.C. Sproul or folks like even John Piper or Kevin DeYoung, those are some examples of very successful, and I mean that in the best of senses. So they're very they're very blessed, and they've blessed the church greatly by being popular theologians. And that's a very needed function, but just to put some names and make things a little more specific, that would be good. Those would be good examples of popular theologians.
Yeah, that's right.
What's the third model? Because this is really, again, the proprietary, this is the secret sauce, which I was so fascinated with.
That's right. Right. And so what we're arguing for is a kind of a term that we've coined, the pastor theologian as ecclesial theologian. And again, this is not to the exclusion of the two models that we've just mentioned. Right. But what we want to argue for is a pastor who is interested in doing and engages in theological scholarship at a high level. It is written not just to one's own congregation, and it's not written to congregants generally, but is written to other theologians. And here, where it gets a little tricky, is that when I say writing to other theologians, people very quickly go, oh, you mean writing to academic theologians. And that is sort of true, but I'm picturing the ecclesial theologian writing primarily to other ecclesial theologians. Now, there isn't an identifiable guild of ecclesial theologians today, so it gets a little tricky to both create the guild at the same time you're trying to create the members of the guild. But we're thinking of pastors that are writing theology that is driven by church concerns that are emerging out of the local congregation or one's ecclesial context, and that has a very distinct doxological pastoral tone to it, and that is pressing towards pastoral, maybe even prophetic type messages for the church. And not that academic theology can't ever get to that place, but it doesn't generally live in that place. And the more that it intersects with the broader university context globally, the more muted the doxology and the pastoral and prophetic impulses of it become. And so I think that there is a really important place for academic theology and academic theologians, believing Christian academic theologians. I think it's a very important place for them. But I think they're in a different conversation than the conversation that the church needs to be having at certain times. And what we've done is we've created a context where we send all of our intellectuals, again, this is not universal, but generally, we send all of our intellectuals into the academy to discuss academic questions and concerns and to do theology according to the rubrics and metrics of the academy. And then we send practitioners into the pastorate. But there's no one really in the pastorate now to really tackle the important theological questions that the church is facing directly. And so here's just maybe a real quick example of some of the disconnect that happens is that you, from the pastorate, I mean, I think we would say this here, all three of us as pastors, that an enormous amount of our time can be taken up on marriage issues, on parenting issues, on the use of personal finances and giving counsel in that, helping people overcome sin and issues with sanctification. But these are questions boundaries in dating relationships or purity issues. Like, these are questions that are very relevant to pastors, but not particularly the hot front burner issues for academics. And so what we get then is we get, I want to be careful here, but we don't get the best minds thinking about the questions that are most pressing to pastors on the ground, because the best minds are thinking about the questions that are most pressing to the academy. And I'm not saying we're not saying in our book that we need to stop sending theologians to the academy. We're just saying we need to have a little bit more of an equitable split that's more representative of the church's history, where in these important institutions, we should have theologians in the academy, but the church is the center of God's mission on the earth, and it should not be bereft of theologians proper itself. So the ecclesial theologian is an attempt to fill a bit of the lacuna that's been left, that I think, like, you'd see like a John Calvin or a Jonathan Edwards would have occupied that place.
Yes.
Where they were neither popular, though they did do popular works, but they were neither academic either. There was kind of this middle area.
Mm-hmm.
And back to, I think, Jim, I think you made the point about specialization. I think that that's another piece in it, that the ecclesial theologian can step back a little bit from the extreme specialization of the academy that I think can at times, that is very useful in some ways, but is not always as helpful theologically and pastorally. And so the ecclesial theologian, we're trying to, in a sense, create a new guild, as it were, of theologians that can do a little bit of a different task that's in conversation with our brethren in the academy, but it's not just trying to reproduce academic theology from the pulpit.
Yes, 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 yes.
Right. So my follow-up question to all that, and that's that it's excellent stuff. We're all fully on board here with that. My question is in terms of implementation and how we change the culture of the church to begin to think along the lines that you have articulated here. I mean, in our context, in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church and in other confessionally reformed denominations, we've been able to kind of hold on to that older tradition, although perhaps with some mitigation for various reasons.
Yeah.
And so when we have examinations of men going into the pastorate, our examinations can be hours long, and so we're already kind of expecting, and we have a standard for the pastor theologian. How do we influence and how do we build a culture of the pastor theologian in an evangelical context where confessionalism, particularly, which kind of aids our context, is not as prevalent?
That is a great question. And I think that it definitely is not a coincidence that it's two pastors who are in an independent church and a free church tradition feel this most acutely enough to write a book on it. I've said to others that if you trace your theological heritage, as it were, back to the first Great Awakening without having to pass the second Great Awakening, you probably might not feel a need for this book as acutely. But if you can only get back to the first Great Awakening by going to the second Great Awakening, which is where I come from, you definitely feel this, I think, more acutely. I think the challenge is greater in that, in denominational contexts or in non-denominational contexts, because we don't have confessional standards and we don't have institutional structures that encourage or support this sort of thing. So I don't know that I have a great answer for it. I mean, the Center for Pastor Theologians is our attempt at this, to at least try to provide some institutional support that is trans-denominational. And I think that more and more things like this will have to emerge. And I don't think that the Center for Pastoral Theologians is going to be the sole answer to it by any means. But hopefully it can stoke the imagination of other denominational contexts or entrepreneurs, as it were, to create more venues. And I think, we have our taxonomy of the local theologian, popular theologian, and ecclesial theologian. I think there's other ways to parse that out. And I would look forward to seeing over the next 10 to 15 years, if we can really get a good conversation started, how the vision that we have for the ecclesial theologian might be tweaked or modified or expanded, or we can add a third category or fourth category in there. But I maybe, again, I think the answer is to provide institutional support that actually resources and networks people that want to do this sort of work.
Yeah,
sure. Now, I think that's good, and I think this is where your book and the center are so very, very helpful and important in our day. I might just go ahead and suggest that independent congregationalist type non-denominational churches consider I think the shortcut would be to become confessional and join with a more confessional structured context ecclesiologically that would lend itself to.
Yeah, whatever theological context that might be.
Right.
Could help.
Whichever one,
right.
It may be different in for different congregations, but I think the structure provided by confessional denominations can help and aid in accelerating the vision that you've set before us.
Yeah, I think that's a good word, a true word.
Now, one thing you mentioned, Gerald, among many others, is the networking and the interaction. And that's something that academics ought to seek after and thrive for, either in professional institutions, but certainly by publishing. They're hoping that many other people will read and then interact with the ideas critically, but helpfully. One thing you mentioned here as you work out the idea of the pastor as ecclesial theologian is that the ecclesial theologian works in partnership with the academic theologian. And one question I have, and maybe you can help me to come to better understanding of the taxonomy, is how ought the two to work together? And more basically, how does an ecclesial theologian differ from perhaps a church-minded or church-concerned academic theologian?
Yeah, that's a great question. Mm. And I'm always careful to just emphasize that the vision we have for the ecclesial theologian is not a replacement of the academic theologian.
Right.
I think that particularly now that the academy is what it is, post-modernity and post-enlightenment, there's a whole set of questions that are emerging in those contexts that pastors, I don't think, are best positioned to try to answer and to solve. And so I really think there is a genuine place for academic theologians to be working in academic contexts. I think also the nature of specialized ministry, as already we've been talked about, or specialized focus of scholarship, is both a blessing and a bane. I mean, there's good things that emerge from that, but it also really can do a number on the ability to even pull together any kind of theological synthesis because you're so narrowly focused on things.
Yeah.
But there is a need for specialization. And here's one of the areas where I think academic scholars and theologians, I think, have more legitimate luxury to specialize than ecclesial theologians do. Mm. And I think there is a need for specialization, and I would just say that's a that is a gift to the ecclesial theologian from the specialist in the academy. So that when you look at the book that we've written, there really isn't any specialist work in that whole in the whole book. Mm-hmm. It's drawing from the specialist work that's been done. It's putting it together in new ways. It's synthesizing some thoughts that that we have, but it's drawing from the work of specialists in the academy. And so I think that one of the major ways that an ecclesial theologian would work with an academic theologian is to benefit from the specialized nature of academic theology. There is, I think, here I'm just going to speak in broad terms. I don't think it's either or, but I think that academic theologians are better positioned to do research and specialized scholarship, whereas I think ecclesial theologians are probably better positioned to do generalist theological synthesis. And so I think both of those need to happen, and I think those can work really well in tandem with each other. I have benefited tremendously from academic theologians, and may their tribe increase.
Yeah,
we want to create another guild that can talk to academic theologians at their intellectual level.
Mm-hmm.
For those academic theologians in particular that care about the church and want their academic work to be in service to the church. But too often, I think their work, and this is part of David Wells's lament, is that their work is disconnected from the church because they don't even have a conversation partner in the church proper, right? So I think that I think academic theologians would benefit, and I've heard from academic theologians that would genuinely benefit from being able to talk to ecclesial type theologians,
yeah,
who can speak to them in their world, in their language, but who have different sets of questions and can help them think through the work that they're doing.
Yeah, I think it's a real symbiotic relationship,
yeah,
where you have specialists and generalists, but also the ecclesial theologian can understand pathways and challenges to an academic's work and argument that they might not be able to see. And vice versa, the ecclesial theologian,
right,
can learn quite a bit having a dialogue partner with the academic theologian. I think both are needed, but right now we for the most part don't have a whole many ecclesial theologians. There might be spread out there, but certainly not to the degree that we hope coming out of this book.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's a very important point. But at the same time, we all have a desire and a yearning to increase the number of ecclesial theologians, to encourage them, to help promote this idea that we would have theologians doing high-level scholarship, but within the context and the immediate social context of the church, and doing this theology for the church. But at the same time, there are just basically practical challenges. And this is what you deal with in Chapter 8. How can the ecclesial theologian be just that in the local church? What are some practical tips, suggestions, both for the theologian, the pastor theologian, but also for the session, for church members, to cultivate an environment where this type of theology can not only thrive, but also be encouraged and in support of the whole?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I would say that, maybe a couple things beyond some of the practical stuff that we then touch on in the chapter. But one is, I think you have to have a pretty clear sense of calling for this, because generally speaking, your local church context will not push you in this direction. So you might have a church context, if you're really fortunate, that will allow for you or be fine with you writing theological works. But it'd be very seldom that you will have a church that encourages you and in a sense almost holds you accountable for being this kind of spokesman, theological spokesman for the larger church. That's, now you have that pressure at some point in the academy, where there is an expectation in certain contexts, not all contexts, frankly, but in some contexts in the academy, the, you know, the publisher perish, we kind of hear this mantra, right, that one's career is advanced through publication. But that just isn't the case for a pastor. So the impulse has to really be born out of a sense of one's vocational calling.
And abilities.
As a pastor.
You know, not every pastor
exactly
is called
right
to be an ecclesial theologian, every pastor aspire to be. It's a certain call.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, and I'm glad you made that point. I think that's exactly right. We're not arguing that every pastor needs to be the ecclesial theologian. That's not right. People have different ministry callings, different ministry gifts, different just ways that the Spirit works through them. So, but if this is something that you feel like the Lord is calling you to, you're going to have to engage in it with a sense of an internal call that has enough sustaining force to kind of move it forward, even though your immediate day-to-day context doesn't have maybe an understanding for it or isn't promoting it or may even be slightly suspicious of it, right? So it's going to have to come interior to yourself because of the Spirit of God laying that on you. That's the first thing. The second thing I would say is you have to be a really good pastor because if you pursue this vision and are not a very good pastor and people feel like they're just being used for you to kind of have your cake and eat it too. What you really like to do is write journal articles and be smart, and you're just using them to pay your way forward in that. It just will not work. So I think you have to really make your congregation feel like they are a priority, and they have to really genuinely be a priority. So beyond those two things, I think pragmatically that one of the things that we've done here at our at our church with the book just coming out, we gave a copy to everyone on our elder board, and all the men are reading it so that they can understand, and we've talked with them about it, of course, but they can get a really full understanding of what it is that we're doing and the value of it. I think congregants, of course, are most concerned about what will immediately benefit their own local congregation, which is understandable. But I think there's something to the idea of we're going to be willing to release our pastor to do some work that benefits the larger Christian community. We're willing, as it were, to tithe out some of our pastor's time, you know, for the betterment of Christ's mission in the world. So I think as they can understand that and have a vision for it, I think that's important. So just helping to educate, as it were. Some more practical things. We generally try to set aside mornings. We have a multi-staff church with about 10 ministry staff, kind of a conglomeration of part-time and full-time. And so we'll generally try to keep mornings free of meetings, so that folks can feel free to have the freedom to study. So that's something that we do in a supervisory way to create space for our staff to do this. I think one could do that if there were a solo pastor in a church to just say, hey, I would also frame it like this too. In mornings, I spend time praying, reading scripture, and writing. And I would keep all those three things together, not just because it sounds better, but because it is better to have all three of those things together so that when people say, I don't want to interrupt him because he's in his study, it's like prayer and scripture reading are part of what's happening in that study. And that this is something, like this is a significant work of God in our pastor's life for him to be doing this kind of thing, right? So so maybe blocking out certain times of the day, that's an important piece of it. I'm trying to think, there's other things that we say there in the book. I think we have 10 things, and they're escaping me here as we're talking.
Well, I think the time commitment is so encouraging, and it's difficult because it's not just having the time, you know, during the time you might be in your study, but you think of your whole life, and you're really just kind of, you know, metaphorically slap many of the readers in the face in a helpful way to say, wake up, you know, and you say, we really don't have any sympathy if you're watching 10 hours of Netflix every
right.
week and then, you know, complain that you don't have any time to write. Well, we need to think about what's important, because at the end of the day, we do tend to make time for the things that are most important to us. And many of us have a lot of opportunities to do good, noble things. But the question is really, what is most important. And for me, in my own life, I, you know, have to constantly ask myself, not the question, is this a good thing to do, but am I best suited to do this particular thing? And is this the best thing to do right now? Well, you know, Matt Perman would ask, what's best next? And that's, those are tough questions, because it means that even good things will sometimes not be accomplished or be passed off or delegated.
That's right. And that, you know, it's interesting. We were talking with Mickey Klink, and he just recently he's one of our CPT fellows, and he just transitioned from a tenured position at Biola, maybe it was Talbot, but he was tenured position out there to a senior pastor here out in Illinois. And it was interesting hearing him talk, because he was saying, you know, people can think on the pastoral side that just being in the academy just like automatically produces a context for you to be very productive theologically. But he said, so many of my colleagues that hadn't written anything in a long, long time, he said, I write stuff because I redeem the moments that I have, even as a professor. And if I just was on autopilot, I would just never have been able to write anything, because there's just always things that could compete with your time. And that was encouraging for me to hear, because it just reminded me that, listen, you know, you will make space for what you really feel like the Lord is calling you to do. And if you just kind of think it's a good idea and you like it, but you don't feel like a little bit of like a woe to me if I fail to preach the gospel sort of thing that the Apostle Paul felt. I mean, I think I have that sense of calling. Like, I feel like if I don't steward this sense of calling that the Lord has given me, I would feel like I was being unfaithful to God's call in my life. And you have to have that sense of conviction, because otherwise, just the busyness of life, let alone the busyness of ministry, will drive away those impulses. And not everybody has that. Not everybody should have that. But I think you need to really prayerfully consider, as you just said, do I have this calling from the Lord? And then what do I need to do to see this become a reality?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a wonderful encouragement. Also, in a sense, a call to action. No doubt many of our listeners are very interested in this topic, and many are pastor theologians of various stripes. But we do encourage you to consider, and also all the church officers who may or may not be pastor theologians themselves, but might have one in their midst or an aspiring one in their midst, consider these things prayerfully. I think the church needs more attention devoted to these matters, and I think the church can certainly grow as we have more ecclesial theologians laboring for the sake of the gospel and for the advancement of Christ's kingdom. Gerald, this has been a fantastic conversation. We really appreciate you writing this book, but also taking the time today to join us and talk about these matters with us for the benefit of our listeners. Thanks for taking the time.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. It's a great pleasure.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Great stuff.
We want to encourage people to visit us online at reformedforum.org. Of course, that's after you visit the Center for Pastor Theologians at pastortheologians.com. There you'll find information about their conference as well as the fellowships. And just be encouraged, there is a video series with Kevin Fanhuser talking about many of these ideas, and we encourage you to visit them and partake of a lot of the things that they've shared with us publicly. But on our website, you can find out information about our other programs as well as how to subscribe. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can send us an email at mail@reformedforum.org, or you can tweet us at Reformed Forum. I want to thank you so much for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.